Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the fastest growing segment of society, to those who know that the world's political, religious, military, and economic institutions are corrupt, that they are counterproductive, that they cannot be fixed. Our mission, therefore, is to look behind the headlines, to know who is working against our interest, to understand why they're doing so, because exposing and condemning errant and treacherous schemes isn't hateful. It's the most caring thing we can do. In our concluding hour, we're going to use evidence and reason to explore the Torah, which means teaching, not law, because its covenant provides the only reliable answer for you and your family. Our phone number, anytime over the next 3 hours, we encourage you to participate in this discussion. It's toll-free, 877-300-7645. The ultimate question is, are you willing to go where the evidence leads, even if a rational evaluation of the evidence leads to a repudiation of your political and religious beliefs? And no one is better equipped to wield that evidence than my good friend I.Q. Al-Rasuli, the author of Lifting the Veil, The True Faces of Muhammad and Islam. Hello, I.Q.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. I want to begin talking about what's called the Syrian Civil War. Unlike you, I don't view it as a civil war. I think it is a proxy war. In fact, I don't think. I know it is a proxy war. And that as a proxy war, we really need to look at what is the likely outcome, how long do we expect this to go on, and what will be the consequence of this proxy war over the next 5, 10, and 15 years. First of all, I just want to reinforce with our audience, are you in concert with my conclusion that this is a proxy war as opposed to a civil war?
It is a proxy war. It's not okay. A civil war.
All right.
17,000 foreign people from all over the Muslim world fighting for jihad. But in fact, they're not fighting for any religion. They're fighting for plunder, for rape, and for subjugation.
Okay, can you tell us the weapons that the jihadists representing the Sunni forces are wielding? Were those weapons available to them in Syria? Did a minority, not a minority, but a sect of Muslims who were essentially out of power? Did they have access to weapons like they are wielding, or were these weapons all brought into the country by the proxies?
They were provided by Europeans and Americans. On the other side, by Russians and by the Iranians.
Okay, and on the American and European side, since the Americans and Europeans don't want to admit that they're actually supplying the weapons, who are their proxies to supply the weapons to the Sunni jihadists?
Well, usually from Turkey and from Libya. And, of course, you've got Qatar and Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, Qatar and Saudi Arabia also. All right, so what we have is a war that's being fought through surrogates, making it a proxy war. Can you tell our audience, IQ, as to why this proxy war is being fought now? What happened between the balance of power between Shia and Sunni Islam that caused the Sunni Muslim nations to want to fight this proxy war to thwart the growing influence of Shia Muslims?
The collapse of Iraq as an independent state due to the invasion in 2001.
Now that conclusion that the Syrian proxy war is being fought on behalf of the Sunni interest in the Middle East and their backers, the United States and Europe, because of the increase in power gained by the Iranians, which is the largest Shiite nation, as a direct result of Iraq no longer being an independent country. America essentially gave Iraq to Iran. That's not known widely, is it? Or if it is known, it's certainly not spoken of widely.
No, the news media will never tell you these things, but the news media never tell American people anything truthful. exaggerating. I'm an outsider looking in. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat, so I don't have any axe to grind either way.
Yeah, you're not even an American. You're an Iraqi who lives in Europe, correct?
Exactly. So, really, I have no income coming from either side to me.
All right.
The important thing is I'm the observer of the field of play. And because I'm not inside the field, I see the whole of the field and all the actors. And what we're seeing here is a disaster, absolute disaster. America should not have interfered in Iraq. They should not have interfered in Libya. They should not have interfered in Egypt. They shouldn't interfere in Syria. And they shouldn't interfere in the Ukraine. This is a new one now.
Yes, of course. Yeah, I know. Since the Ukraine is an entirely different area of malfeasance, let's stick to what's happening in Syria and the fact that it was caused by America. Would it be safe to say that in the Islamic Middle East, prior to America's invasion of Iraq, that the government of Iraq, particularly Saddam Hussein, was the single most effective leader in the Islamic world in combating Islamic terrorism?
There was no terrorism in Iraq because the terrorist was Saddam Hussein. And he controlled Iraq with an iron fist. By the way, that's not a negative thing.
No.
Muslims cannot be controlled by democracy. Muslims only understand one language, which is either theocracy or autocracy dictatorship.
All right. So if you were to pick a country in the Islamic world with the least amount of, let's use the term the media loves, Al-Qaeda presence, and if you were to take all of the Islamic world, particularly in the Middle East, and say, which country had the least amount of Islamic terrorism, particularly Al-Qaeda influence, wouldn't it have been Iraq?
Iraq, definitely. After that would be Egypt and Libya. The reason I'm mentioning them, because these two countries also were, their leaders were deposed by the Americans, not by the Europeans, by the Americans. Mm-hmm. And what do we have now? We have Qaeda.
Yeah. Yeah. So the invasion of Iraq, if the stated purpose was to fight against and to eliminate Islamic terrorism, it had exactly the opposite consequence. The least amount of Islamic terrorism was in Iraq before we invaded, and after America invaded, it is now the most terrorized nation on earth.
Literally, Iraq today is the most terrorizing. Every single day, between 30 to 70 people are killed. Every single day.
And the only difference between it being the least terrorized nation in the Islamic world, as it relates to fundamentalist Islamic terrorism, and the most terrorized nation is the U.S. invasion. That's the only thing that changed from the least to the most, correct?
Definitely. But I go back again. The same thing in Libya and the same thing in Egypt. Egypt
isn't
the terror the way they have now. Never.
Correct. Yes, correct.
Not under Abdel Nasser. Not under Mubarak.
Yeah. So, beyond the fact that that the invasion was obviously counterproductive from the amount of terrorism that is being experienced in Iraq today versus previously, we also have the issue of by ridding Iran of its only tangible enemy and effectively giving Iraq to Iran, the United States dramatically increased the influence of Shia Islam in the heart of the Middle East. Isn't that true?
That's a fact. By the way, while we're talking about it, Obama is giving them the atom bomb also.
That's correct. Probably already has.
Yes, probably. But in my opinion, humble as it may be, they already have it.
Yeah.
But they don't have to shout about it.
Right.
Because one bomb is not good enough. They have to accumulate more. By the way, I mean, it's a fact of life that American intelligence from 1945 till today, they have always underestimated the time scale of which any country will have atom bombs, like Russia, like China, like Korea, like India and Pakistan. They were wrong in
every
single case.
Yeah. How long did it take the United States to develop a nuclear bomb? From start to finish.
In 1942 to 1945, 3 years.
Three years.
They had the greatest concentration of money and brains to do it.
Right. Okay. It took 3 years, right?
Yes.
And then following the time that the United States developed the bomb, how many years did it take Russia to develop their atomic bomb?
1949.
Yeah. So four years. And if you trace the development of an atomic bomb amongst countries now that have dedicated themselves to the project, it's typically in the 5 to 10 year range. That is the maximum, because today there are plans all over the internet for fission bombs.
Yeah, because the technology is available and it's much more advanced. And they can buy it off the shelf from Pakistan. They can buy it off the shelf from Korea. By the way, Korea and North Korea and Iran are literally intertwined.
Yeah.
With regarding the nuclear technology.
Yeah, what I'm convinced of, and then I want to return to Syria. We'll have to do it after the break. But I'm convinced that the reason that Iran blew up and literally bulldozed its facility for centrifugal explosions, which is the triggering device for the fission bomb, built it, used it, has now bulldozed it. And that the reason that they have agreed to the status quo position with the world relative to getting all the sanctions released is that they have one or more nuclear bombs. And that now all they're doing is simply refining fissionable material to have more bombs while they are working with the North Koreans on increasing the range and accuracy of their intercontinental ballistic missiles.
Correct. I have no doubt about it. In my opinion, exactly.
Yeah, I'm convinced that that is true as well. When we return, now that we have framed the picture so that you understand what is happening in Syria and who the parties are and why they are fighting, we're going to have a discussion with IQ al-Rasuli as to who is going to prevail and what the consequence of that's going to be by examining the percentage of Sunnis versus Shiites and the weapons that they hold. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with IQ al-Rasuli, who is an Iraqi by birth. He lives in Europe now. And we're talking about the situation in Syria, which is a proxy war between Shia and Sunni Muslims, one that was started because of America's counterproductive invasion of Iraq, giving Iraq to Iran. So now I want to evaluate the likely outcome with the IQ al-Rasuli of that proxy war. So IQ, my first question to you, worldwide, what is the ratio of Shia to Sunni Muslims?
Theoretically, the Shia is 15% to 18%. Nobody knows exactly. And the remainder, 85 to 82% are the Sunni Muslims.
Okay, so Sunni Muslims worldwide outnumber Shia Muslims 4 to 1, maybe 5 to 1, maybe 5 to 1. In the Middle East, by the way, as I understand it, those are the worldwide numbers. Those numbers are exactly the same range that I have researched. In the Middle East, however, the number is different because, of course, there are so many Sunni Muslims in places like Indonesia and Malaysia and places like that. As I understand it, in the Middle East, it's a little more even, with about 61 to 62% being Sunnis and 38 to 39% being Shia. Is that also consistent?
That's okay. Also correct, yes.
Okay. So, in a way, if we were to look at the American Civil War, which was a civil war as opposed to a proxy war, so it's a little different. But in the American Civil War, the population difference was not quite as extreme. But yet, there was really no chance that in an ongoing war, the South had any chance to prevail over the North, because the North's population was just too much greater than the South. Now, let's look at the next item that we can consider. There are some 55 or so, between 55 and 60 Islamic majority nations in the world. Is that accurate?
57.
Okay, so there's 57. That's right between 55 and 60. 57 majority Islamic nations in the world. Soon to be 58, because I think Nigeria is right there at the threshold. Of those, how many of them are Shia majority?
The majority are, you've got maybe three of them. Iran is definitely one of them. Iran is another one. Right. Bahrain, I think, is the third one.
Yep. Azerbaijan is really close. Bahrain is really close. And so it's really Iran, Iraq. Syria is not, but it's controlled by them. Azerbaijan and Bahrain. So you're looking at four countries maximum.
Out
of 57. Okay. So the odds are more than 10 to 1 in terms of national government support for Sunnis versus Shia, correct?
Correct.
All right. Let's look at military spending, if we will. Because that was another factor, for example, in the American Civil War. The North out-manufactured the South in terms of, and out-purchased the South in terms of weapons by a huge margin. So on the proxy side, you've got the United States with a defense budget of $682 billion. And on the other side, you have Russia and China, which combine at $256 billion. So almost 2.5 to 1, American weapons and American spending on weaponry versus Russia and China combined. Let's put the proxies aside, but that's 2.5 to 1. That's a lot.
Yes.
All right. Now let's look at the weapons spending, the war spending by the Sunni nations engaged in this battle and interested in this battle versus the Shia. I'm going to list off the spending of the Sunni nations. Saudi Arabia, $57 billion. Turkey, $18 billion. United Arab Emirates, $14 billion. Algeria, $9 billion. Pakistan, $7 billion. Indonesia, $7 billion. Oman, $7 billion. Malaysia, $5 billion. Egypt, $4 billion. Morocco, $3 billion. Libya, $3 billion. The Sudan, $2 billion. Tajikistan, $2 billion. And then there are about 30 other Sunni majority countries that collectively are anywhere from 1.5 down to about $500 million, collectively at $15 billion. That totals $153 billion spent by the 50-some-odd Sunni majority Islamic nations. $153 billion. Iraq spending is $6 billion. Iran spending is $6 billion. Syria is $2 billion. Azerbaijan and Bahrain collectively at about $1.5 billion. That totals $16 billion. It's 10 to 1 in military spending. How does any side win a war when they're outspent 10 to 1 in weaponry? We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with IQ Al Rasuli about the proxy war that's taking place in Syria. IQ, do you think that the war that is currently taking place in Syria is going to be wrapped up quickly, or do you think this is likely to go on for some time?
I believe it's going to go on for some time.
Okay.
Because nobody is trying to settle the issue in an amicable way, or even in an intelligent way.
I'm not even sure it can. Yeah, I'm not even sure it can be settled. I mean, the jihadists that have invaded and that are working to as you say, rape and plunder, but also to impose Islamic law in Syria, are never going to accept anyone associated with Shiite Islam. And therefore, they're never going to accept Assad, who is essentially a secularist. And Assad is never going to resign, because he's a dead man if he does. And Iran's not going to back down either. So I don't even know if there is even a remotely a possibility that there could even be a negotiated settlement.
Okay, I accept that, but to go there, what Obama is thinking about, or the in fact, congressmen are pushing Obama to start a war. A war where?
No, no.
How are they going to interfere with the internal affair of another state, no matter how depraved that state is? I don't understand.
Yeah, I hope that the United States does not intervene. I think, based upon the prophecies that I have read, and I shared a little bit of them with you last week, I think the United States does ultimately intervene, but not early on in the process. But bottom line here is, you and I both come to the conclusion with a full understanding of what Islam represents, what it actually is, what is genuinely occurring in this proxy war, that there is no end in sight, that this is going to be an ongoing war and there is no solution to it.
Well, it's a war to the death, because right. Neither side can give up without literally committing suicide.
Yeah. By the way, that's what Yanwa's prophecy said. It's a war to the death, that they continue to fight until the jihadists find no one left to terrorize. That being the case, and that is the only rational conclusion that can be drawn from this particular war, that being the case, wouldn't you expect the side that is hugely outmanned and substantially outgunned, 10 to 1 outgunned, and anywhere from 3 to 1 to 4 to 1 outmanned. In a long, protracted war, isn't the side that is outmanned and outgunned going to lose?
Theoretically, yes. But when they get the atom bomb, no matter how outgunned and outmanned, if they're willing to use it, they have the upper hand.
Well, let's just say that we don't deal with the atomic bomb up to this point. If there is no nuclear attack, then
the Shia
are going to lose, aren't they?
Definitely.
And, yeah, and that's by that.
Simple arithmetic, nothing to do with mathematics.
Right. Simple arithmetic. 10 to 1 in weaponry, anywhere from 3 to 4 to 1 in terms of manpower. There's just no comparison. The Shia are going to lose. Ultimately, the Shia are going to lose. Now, the only thing that the Shia can do to, well, they can't do anything to prevent losing. They can alter the consequence of losing such that, they turn, Damascus and the populated areas of Syria into molten glass. They could use an atomic bomb, but
yes.
that's not prevailing, is it?
No, no.
I mean, there literally, be nothing left.
It's self-destructive. It really is.
Right, right, right. So there's nothing. If they choose to use the atomic bomb, there is nothing left of Syria. So that would be no one prevails. Yeah. Yeah, the prophecies, by the way, are that that the government of Syria is no more, and that the marauding bands of terrorists get to the point where there's essentially no civilians left for them to kill. So that's where we that's what is predicted. Now, with Syria now under Assad, and you know, he's a bad dude, no question about it. But with Syria under Assad, is that country an immediate threat to world stability?
It never was a threat to anybody.
Well, they attacked Israel.
Anybody.
Yeah, well, they attacked Israel three times.
We're not discussing Israeli-Arab conflict now.
Okay.
All I'm saying is, was Syria a threat to the world? The answer is no. No. Even in his confrontation with Israel, he was extremely clever and did not interfere with Israel. No matter how many times he said he was to Golan, he didn't do anything.
Right. Yes. Syria under Assad is no threat to the world and has not been a threat that Israel has had any trouble dealing with since 1948. Is that correct? Okay.
Yes.
Now, what's going to happen when this, should the jihad finally end because there's just no one left to kill? and the Syrian government falls, and the jihadists from some 75 to 100 countries around the world, including the United States and Britain and throughout Europe and really throughout the world, when they return home after having fought the this great jihad, are they going to give up the jihad, or do you think they're going to continue to try to fight jihad when they return to countries like the United States and Great Britain?
I wouldn't use the word think. I know.
Yeah.
They are going to use. And in fact, Britain and France and Germany and America are worried about those who went to Syria and coming back. They will come back not only hardened criminals, not only mass murderers, but they will be knowledgeable on how to mass murder. And they will apply it.
Right. In fact, we have a case study on this. There was a previous great jihad called exactly the same terms, fought by exactly the same people, fought supported by exactly the same countries, orchestrated with the same ally. But when the great jihad was orchestrated by the United States using mujahideen that were imported from around the world in Afghanistan, back in the late 1970s, we witnessed what happens after they prevail in a great jihad and they go back home. 9/11 was the result. 9/11 was the result, wasn't it? And the bombings in Kenya and Tanzania and throughout the world, all of the attacks in Spain. Yes, Spain, the UK,
and Germany, and Italy,
right,
and France.
So we played this game before.
Yes, but nobody learned anything from it.
Yeah, we played this game before, and the results were that the Islamic Mujahideen that we gave weapons to and that we encouraged to kill in Afghanistan, when they prevailed in the Great Jihad, they went back to their countries and they continued to be jihadists, and that's why we had this huge upwelling of Islamic terrorism. We're playing exactly the same game again, aren't we?
You forgot to add that when the Great Jihad was done against the Soviet Union,
mm-hmm,
and when the Soviets were chucked out, the Taliban took over.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And then Osama bin Laden was given a beautiful place to stay in. That's what the Great Jihad did.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, if you look at Afghanistan under the influence of the Soviet government, versus in the wake of the American intervention through renting the Taliban and Al-Qaeda from Pakistan and imposing fundamentalist Islamic rule through the Taliban, Afghanistan itself was the victim. They lost dearly, as did the world as a whole.
They are going to lose more now. Now that America is leaving Afghanistan and Karzai thinks he's going to take over, he's out of his mind. He is not going to take over. The Taliban will be taking over before the end of this year. I promise you that the Taliban will take over.
Are you familiar with what's called the Iraqi Study Group? I'll give you a little background here, and then it may ring a bell. If not, I'll share the conclusions with you. But the Iraqi Task Force was created for the express purpose of trying to deal with the negative outcome of America's invasion of Iraq. When America invaded Iraq, it took a country that had essentially no terrorism at all, and there was an explosion of terrorism to the point where tens of thousands of Sunni and Shia were killing one another, and we started a civil war, a Sunni-Shia civil war in Iraq. And so that there was this Iraqi study group put together by Americans, politicians, for the express purpose of figuring out how do we resolve this problem of Sunnis killing Shias in Iraq. Are you aware that there was such a group?
Not really, no.
Okay. It's interesting to study. Let me show you what their conclusion was. Their conclusion was, if we want to resolve the problem, we should force Israel to give up the West Bank and Gaza to the Palestinians, and that will resolve the issue, because that's the common desire of all Muslims. And so their solution was to capitulate on Israel and give up the West Bank.
Are you serious?
I'm absolutely serious. That's the published recommendation of the Iraqi study group.
And those are supposed to be intelligence. Muslims men?
Yes, supposed to be.
Good God. No wonder America is losing all over the world.
Yes. So right now, as America tries to resolve the rage of jihadist Muslims throughout the Middle East, what is Kerry doing at this very moment?
Well, trying to force Israel to give up her life.
Right.
Yes,
exactly.
That's what he's trying to do.
Exactly. So if this war in Syria continues the way that it is, and there's really no reason to, in fact, there is no scenario that anyone can come up with that would suggest that it's not going to continue until the point that the Assad regime is done asunder, which means now it's going to be, Syria is going to be a larger and more militant version of Libya, which is nothing now but an Islamic terrorist state. What do you think the world's going to say is the solution to tone down this Islamic rage, and particularly to keep these returning jihadists from taking out Western countries which are, they believe, are allied with Israel?
They will sell Israel.
Correct.
They did Czechoslovakia 70 years ago.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly what Yahweh, by the way, predicted, that will be the consequence. It is what we have done in the past. It's what we are doing presently. It's what we're going to do in the near future. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm having a conversation with IQ Al-Rasuli, the foremost expert on the true nature of Islam. IQ, we've been over a lot of territory here. And the whole purpose of this discussion was to understand what is occurring so that we can correctly ascertain what's going to occur and the consequence of it. And it seems to me, and it's based upon your commentary, IQ, it seems to me that this proxy war is absolutely going to cost the Syrian government. The Syrian government will ultimately lose because they're out armed and outmanned, and that when they lose, we have an example in the past of jihadists going back to their countries and perpetrating acts of terror in those countries, and we have an example of what those countries are going to attempt to do to try to diminish their rage. And it seems to me like this all leads once again to forcing Israel to capitulate, and that it's going to fail. Is there any part of that reasoning that is either flawed, or that there is a chance that it will happen differently next time?
I don't think it will happen differently. I think you're on the right track.
And if that,
you don't learn anything from history.
That's correct. So if that being the case, and everything that we've witnessed in the past indicates that this is the 1-2-3 of what's happening in the Syrian war. That being the case, do we have an example of what happens when countries around the world force other countries to capitulate, to surrender, and making themselves vulnerable? When we appease tyrants like in the past Nazi Germany and now with Muslims.
We have World War III. We would have World War III. That is guaranteed. 100%.
Can't be avoided, can it?
No. It's not 99%. It's 100%.
Yeah. So the moment Israel is made more vulnerable so that it can no longer defend itself and forced into that position by the world, because the world is going to have these marauding, returning jihadists who are going to be perpetrating grotesque acts of terror just as they did following the great jihad in Afghanistan, this time the great jihad in Syria. There will be no way to stop the war, will there?
But I want Americans who are listening to understand something. Jihad has absolutely nothing to do with Israel. It has nothing to do with Christianity. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with Buddhism.
Right.
It has nothing to do with anything. Jihad is against every human being who's not a Muslim.
Right.
It's that simple. It's not complicated.
I would stretch the point one point further, IQ, and I don't think you're going to disagree with this, but I want to challenge you on this point. If there were no Christians in the world, if there were no agnostics, there were no atheists, there were no Jews, there were no Hindus, there was no other religion in the world other than Islam. If Islam got its wish list and they annihilated every other person and got the remaining people who survived to submit to Islam, would Islam be capable of peace, or would jihad continue?
Jihad will continue because each sect will destroy the other sect.
and even worse than that, according to the Quran, at that point, there would be a rise of peaceful Muslims. And what is a peaceful Muslim, according to the Quran?
Jihadi.
Well, no, a peaceful Muslim is a hypocrite, and the jihadi Muslims are ordered to kill them. A peaceful Muslim, according to Allah, is in the process of being killed so that he can torture them.
Yep.
So there will never be peace. You could give Muslims everything that they want, including Israel, and it's not going to change anything. We have a few more minutes left. IQ, Glenn has called in and either has a question or a statement that he'd like you to consider. Hi, Glenn.
Yes, hello. Yeah, hello, IQ. Hi, are you there?
Yes.
Hi. I listening to what you say about these things, and I have to admit, things are by no means progressing as I would like them to, but they are progressing very much as I would expect them to,
mm-hmm.
from the scriptures, from
yes, exactly.
The Torah. I mean, Genesis chapter 6, okay, world
right.
is full of violence. As in the days of Noah, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be.
Yep.
And so it fits according to biblical and according to biblical.
Yeah.
And I know you don't buy into the Pike's letter to Mazzini, but they specifically state they intend to foment, you know, a horrific cataclysm that will kill huge numbers of people. And this gradual building of all these tensions and these interventions and these proxy wars and mercenaries and all that, it's turning the world precisely into a Genesis 6, you know, pre-Noah scenario. And then I further think that at some point, just as, you know, after the new thing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki saw the signing of the treaty that ended World War II, I personally think it will be the undoing of Damascus that immediately precedes the signing of the treaty.
You know, the handwriting is on the wall. We need to go for the commercial and news break. We'll be back.